From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's getting testy on Capitol Hill. Today, Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee are laying out facts collected during open and closed-door hearings that they say make the case for impeachment of President Trump because he, in effect, bribed Ukraine to investigate a political rival. Here's the Democratic Judiciary Committee Chair, Gerald Nadler, opening the hearing.
Multiple witnesses, including respected diplomats, national security professionals, and decorated war veterans, all testified to the same basic fact. President Trump withheld the aid and the meeting in order to pressure a foreign government to do him that favor. President Trump put himself before country.
President Trump refused to take part in the hearings, but his allies, including the ranking Republican Doug Collins, are fiercely defending him today and accusing Democrats of running a sham process.
Why? Because they have the means. They have the motive, and they have the opportunity. And at the end of the day, all this is about a clock and a calendar, because they can't get over the fact Donald Trump is president of the United States, and they don't have a candidate that they think can beat him. It's all political.
NPR's congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us. And Claudia, so far today we're hearing from lawyers for and against impeachment. This is more of a trial. You know, they're making their cases. But what is the goal at this point in the process? Where are we?
Yes, today lawmakers are laying down the groundwork for articles of impeachment. And today is more of a highlights reel, if you will, of all the findings from the House Intelligence Committee as they investigated these claims of a pressure campaign led by the president to extract an investigation of his political rival. And it started with lawyers for the Judiciary Committee presenting their arguments for and against impeachment, followed by lawyers for the House Intelligence Committee presenting their findings during the formal impeachment probe.
And what are the major takeaways from the Democrats? Let's start there.
So they are saying that it's part the president's behavior is part of a larger pattern of taking risks and abusing the power of his office to accept foreign assistance to interfere in our elections. They are highlighting witness testimony showing that they could corroborate the central whistleblower complaint that the president was trying to pressure Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 elections on his behalf, and saying this evidence presents the strongest possible case for impeachment. They are saying the president put himself before country and broke his oath of office, and this pattern of behavior presents an ongoing risk to the country.
And just to lay out some of the things the Republicans are saying, it's predictable from both sides, but what are we hearing today?
Yes, they are revisiting claims that the Ukrainian leader didn't feel any pressure to conduct an investigation on Trump's behalf. They're saying that officials in Kyiv didn't know about a pause in security assistance, and saying witnesses in the probe who said there was such a pressure campaign for assistance were making assumptions, and that much of the aid was released in the end without any of these investigations being conducted. They're also focusing on the process, making motions to delay the hearing and demand their own hearing focused on Republican witnesses. They call it a minority day, which Chairman Nadler has said remains under consideration.
Well, I want to hear a little bit of that. It's been really contentious. But first, to the Republicans' case they seem to be making today, they seem to be going directly at, you know, this nothing happened. There was nothing to see here. But isn't there a problem there? Because for a long time, we were hearing, including from the president's top aide, Mick Mulvaney, who said in a press conference, there was leverage and too bad, get over it, or words to that effect.
Yes, this weekend we heard from Democratic aides who told us that today would look like when worlds collide, as Democrats give their narrative of what they found through their investigations and Republicans do hit back and say, no, there's nothing there, as you just mentioned. So it is a difficult battle of words and narratives, if you will. And both sides is hoping that their narrative will win out in the end.
Well, again, which narrative in some cases? Look, as you mentioned, it's been contentious. Republicans have tried to stymie the proceedings at every turn. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
You will now hear presentations of evidence.
I have a parliamentary inquiry.
I haven't removed my objection yet.
I will not recognize a parliamentary inquiry at this time. We will now hear presentations of evidence from counsel to the judiciary.
Is this when we just hear staff ask questions of other staff and the members get dealt out of this whole hearing? And for the next 4 hours, you're going to try to overturn the result of an election with unelected people giving testimony?
Gentlemen will suspend.
Look, that last voice there is Nadler, and before that, the Republican Matt Gaetz. What are they fighting over?
So Matt Gaetz and other Republicans say that their voices are being shut out today so they can hear testimony for lawyers for the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees. And Republicans are saying this is your attempt to try and overturn the election results from 2016 and argue against impeachment.
But isn't this, I mean, the 30 seconds we have, isn't this how it goes? I mean, isn't this what's supposed to happen today, hearing from lawyers?
This was definitely expected. They were told that they were going to lay out the groundwork, everything they had uncovered during the investigations. But that's not going to stop Republicans from stepping in and try to stop the process every opportunity they get.
Okay. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as impeachment hearings continue over President Trump in Ukraine, that country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is in France to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Their meeting is part of peace talks to end the war between Russia-backed separatists and Ukrainian forces in the eastern part of Ukraine. An estimated 14,000 people have been killed in the conflict over the last 5 years. The BBC's Jonah Fisher joins us from Paris. And Jonah, we can hear that you're outside. Where are you and what are you seeing?
Yeah, I'm at the Elysee Palace. The leaders of Germany, France, Ukraine and Russia are all here. They are at the moment holding a series of bilateral discussions, and then it will climax with a four-way discussion, all aimed at discussing the problems in eastern Ukraine, the continuing conflict there, and attempts to really reboot and breathe new life into attempts to solve the many issues in eastern Ukraine.
Jonah, we've also been hearing that thousands of Ukrainians have been rallying at the capital in Kyiv, demanding that the president keep the country's interests centered to these discussions that are going to happen today. Is there any expectation that these talks there in Paris will actually end the war?
Well, look, many people in Ukraine, and with some justification, regard Russia as having effectively invaded parts of eastern Ukraine and to be funding and supporting the rebel groups that now occupy those parts of eastern Ukraine. So the idea for them that Ukraine might make concessions, that there might be some sort of flexibility or some sort of deal made with a country which they see as the aggressor country, that horrifies them. And that's what we've seen in Kyiv with the demonstrations. It does have to be said that at the moment, the demonstrations are in the thousands rather than the tens of thousands. So nothing that has reached a scale that would have President Zelensky extremely worried. But it's a reminder, I think, to him that any agreement that does emerge from these talks, and I don't think anyone's expecting there to be a deal today, but perhaps further down the line, some sort of agreement on eastern Ukraine, that it will be a very difficult deal for him to sell to everyone in Ukraine, because there are plenty of people who view the idea of making some sort of deal with Russia as simply not acceptable as a starting point.
You know, Jonah, from the outside, it really seems that Putin has the upper hand in any negotiations with Zelensky. I mean, we know that Putin is an experienced world leader. Zelensky was just elected this year. Can you talk a little bit more about that dynamic?
Look, a year ago, Vladimir Zelensky was a comedian. He wasn't even a politician. Now he is a president. He is sitting down with the leaders of France, Germany and Russia. But it is important to reflect on the geopolitical position of Ukraine. We know that Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel are both interested in trying to find a way to improve Europe's relationship with Russia. So there is an element of pressure coming from them towards Mr. Zelensky to try and come to some sort of agreement, come to some sort of deal with Russia. There is also, and I think this is in the back of President Zelensky's mind, the fact that the relationship with the United States, a key relationship for Ukraine in terms of that conflict in eastern Ukraine, well, it is no longer as rock solid as it once was. Ukraine has, of course, found itself embroiled in the impeachment investigation in the United States. Military assistance was frozen over the course of this summer. So where once I think Ukraine felt that the United States had Ukraine's back, if you like, that is no longer the case. They can't count on the White House and the United States in quite the same way as they once could.
Can we talk a little bit about the details of what's going to be talked about today? So from my understanding, Russia wants to use this summit to increase pressure on Zelensky to fulfill the 2015 peace accord. What exactly is that? And we know that Zelensky is pushing to tweak the timeline laid out on that accord.
Yeah, look, in very general terms, the discussions will revolve around what happens to these rebel-controlled parts of eastern Ukraine. And they, in the height of the fighting back in 2014 and 2015, they came up with a formula in the Minsk agreements, which basically involved having elections, giving them a sort of a special autonomous status, and for then Russian-backed forces to leave and for Ukraine to get control of the border again. The big concern from the Ukrainian part is that they agree to elections, they agree to an autonomous status, and then Russia doesn't actually pull its people out of eastern Ukraine, and they never get the control of the border back. And all they will have done will have effectively legitimized the people, the rebels, who are now running that part of eastern Ukraine.
The BBC's Jonah Fisher speaking with us from Paris. Jonah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Chip Brantley.
And I'm Andrew Beck Grace. We're the hosts of the NPR podcast White Lies, a story about guilt and memory that says as much about America today as it does about the past.
Apple just named White Lies the best true crime show of the year. And if you haven't listened yet, you can binge the entire series now wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.
As we bring you the latest from the impeachment hearings, we also want to catch up on other news, so let's do that now. In Pensacola, Florida, the FBI is looking into why a member of the Saudi Royal Air Force in a U.S. training program on the naval base there opened fire, killing three people before deputies shot and killed him. Investigators are assuming it was an act of terrorism. Former Homeland Security official Juliette Kayyem told NPR's Steve Inskeep earlier on Morning Edition that people in this military program are vetted before coming to the U.S.
There's a vetting process done by the Department of Defense. It looks at three major categories: drug use, mental stability or instability, and then, of course, ties to terrorism. That vetting goes at the process of entry into the United States. And, of course, you know, we work with a country like Saudi Arabia to learn more about him. That vetting is not recurring.
Kayyem said since the Saudi man came to the U.S. 3 years ago, a big question now is whether his vetting process should have been recurring, since a lot can change with a person over 3 years. We're also watching in awe that volcanic eruption in New Zealand. At least five people have died, many others still missing. Most were on guided tours. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern spoke at a news conference about the eruption at White Island, calling it an evolving situation.
We know that there were a number of tourists on or around the island at the time, both New Zealanders and visitors from overseas. I know there will be a huge amount of concern and anxiety for those who have loved ones on or around the island at the time. And I can assure them police are doing everything they can.
Some of the 18 people who survived the volcano eruption are being treated for severe burns. And there are questions now as to why tourists were allowed on the island, even though scientists recently observed an increase in volcanic activity there. Meanwhile, in Madrid, the UN COP25 climate change talks are set to continue all this week. Teenage activist Greta Thunberg of Sweden is there. She spoke earlier, but only briefly, wanting to give the stage to others.
It is the people, especially from the global south and from indigenous communities, who need to tell their stories. Because the climate emergency is not just something that will impact us in the future. It is not something that will have an impact on children living today when they grow up. It is already affecting countless of people today. People are suffering and dying from it today.
Indigenous activists at COP25 followed Thunberg, saying leaders need to find solutions to the climate crisis that weave together science and spirituality. On the entertainment front, Golden Globe nominations are out, and Netflix is leading the pack with its drama Marriage Story, starring Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson as a director and an actor navigating a divorce and sharing a life with their young son, Henry. It gets heated.
You're exactly like your mother. Everything you're complaining about her, you're doing. You're suffocating Henry.
First of all, I love my mother. She was a wonderful mother.
Just repeating what you told me.
Secondly, how dare you compare my mothering to my mother? I may be like my father, but I am not like my mother.
You are!
Another Netflix film also dominating the Golden Globe nominations is Martin Scorsese's gangster movie The Irishman. Another note, former Fed Chair Paul Volcker died today at 92. We're going to have more on his legacy elsewhere in the program. But right now, we say goodbye to Big Bird's best friend, Carol Spinney died Sunday at 85. For almost 50 years, Spinney inhabited both the trash can dweller Oscar the Grouch and the 8-foot-2 big yellow bird with the innocence of a child, Sesame Street's Big Bird.
Well, I'm not all alone. Why, there's Gordon and Susan.
But they're not birds like we are.
I know, but they're nice people.
But you should have a home and a family.
Well, I am home. I like it here on Sesame Street.
Jim Henson created the Muppets, but Carol Spinney gave two of them life. In 2003, he stopped by to talk about his memoir, The Wisdom of Big Bird and the Dark Genius of Oscar the Grouch, Lessons from a Life in Feathers.
I read in your book that Big Bird started out as kind of a local yokel. And when did he become a child?
Well, it wasn't long that he was a local yokel. Jim Henson had personally discovered me doing my own show called Pickle Puss and Friends. To me, it was like if I was a drummer, he'd say, I've got a little band from Liverpool. Would you like to be me drummer then? And it was Jim Henson asking me. I couldn't believe it. He built the bird around me, and he asked, I asked him, what is he like? And he said, gee, I've been thinking of him as a puppet, but I haven't thought who he's going to be. He said, well, maybe it's like a nice, amiable, goofy guy like Goofy, Mickey Mouse's pal. And we weren't doing the show very long before I said, you know, I think it'd be better if he were a child, because he's trying to learn the alphabet, and he wanted to join a bunch of little kids in a daycare center in one of our scenes. And I said, I don't think you'd want him there as Goofy, but I think he might be there as a child who hasn't learned much yet, even though he's 8'2".
I also just worshipped Jim Henson, and his passing was just horrendous. And so I was devastated to read that he wasn't all that sentimental about
the characters.
Well,
I'm almost sorry I put it that way, because it sounds like he was cold. There was nothing cold about him. He just was he was a true genius.
But he was surprised that you talked to the puppets,
well, I guess I'm a little silly maybe, but Ernie, he had to drop on the floor because he had a quick change to another puppet. And so Ernie was in his way, and he kind of shoved him aside with his foot. And I picked Ernie up and said, gee, Ernie, he didn't mean that. And he said, why, are you sentimental about the puppets? And I said, well, yeah, I guess if the character that you build for them eventually becomes quite real to you.
Yeah. And does that say something about you and what you brought to Big Bird? Because you've said that the most important component of Big Bird to you is compassion.
Well, that's what I've kind of developed. First he became the child, and he was kind of sweet and amiable, and he also was able to get angry and pout and do all the things that kids can do. But one day, actually, I was walking back from Sesame Street, and this little old man, he looked kind of upset, and he was standing there, and I said, is there anything wrong, sir? Mm. And he said, well, I haven't been well, and I'm living alone. And if I fall, there's no one to take care of me. I said, well, would you like to take my arm? And I walked him a few blocks, and he thanked me. The next day, I just couldn't get it out of my mind, and I went to work the next day, and I suggested to one of our producers, couldn't Big Bird do something to teach compassion?
Yeah.
And she said, well, maybe you could just put it into his character. About 3 years later, reading a newspaper telling about the different characters, he said, and then there's the compassionate Big Bird. And I said, yes, success. I must have done something right.
And it is. It's Big Bird that cries with Mr. Snuffleupagus when they have discussion about whether or not they can have imaginary friends, turn out not to be imaginary. And
right.
It's Big Bird that cries when he learns that Mr. Hooper has died, and all the children watching learn. I'm getting a little choked up when I talk about it. You know, so it's Big Bird that brought those moments to us.
Yes, and it was, that was what I realized I'd gone a long way from just being, you know, I was Grandma Nellie the clown on Bozo Show.
Well, you know, it's the most amazing thing. Everywhere Big Bird is, you are. It's just the weirdest thing. And so I'm wondering, is Big Bird here now?
I'll see. Big Bird?
What is it?
Come here a minute.
Oh, hi. Who's this?
Hi, Big Bird. It's Robin.
Oh, hello, Robin. You don't look like a bird.
That's right. You're the bird. You're a big bird. How old are you?
Well, I'm 6 now. Bird years, though. Oh. Not quite the same as yours.
No. Well, Big Bird, I know you've been doing a lot of interviews along with your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Big Bird, what's the silliest thing people are asking you? Because people can ask the silliest things.
Well, this morning, somebody asked me all about what's my opinion about dating.
Oh.
I didn't know what that word means.
When they tell you about the birds and the... Oh, wait, you already know about the birds.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Oscar, get out of the... He's in your wastebasket. Oscar.
No.
Hey. Hey, look, I'm looking for good stuff in here. I love trash.
Hi, Oscar.
We all know that, Oscar.
Oscar, you know what I want to know? Oscar, are you really as grouchy as people say?
I'm a little grouchier than that. Particularly today, I got up on the right side of the bed. I hate that.
Yeah. Big Bird, how do you... You know, Oscar sometimes can be so grouchy, and, you know, he's making a mess right now in our garbage can.
Oscar, you're making a mess.
How do you... How do you feel about that, Big Bird? Sometimes he's kind of rude.
Yeah, but he's nice. I kind of like most people. He just pulls lots of tricks on me. And he also calls me an overgrown bag of giblets. Hey, I'm glad to make you unhappy. Oscar, you want to make him unhappy? Well, not exactly. I like to frustrate the turkey. I'm not a turkey!
Okay, all right. No, we're not going to fight. Do you find yourself talking to Big Bird and Oscar a lot?
Yeah, I often feel that Big Bird is sort of like a little boy to me. I'm glad to know him. Mm. And he's not me, but yet I seem to feel I know him very well, and I have a very fatherly feeling towards him.
Yeah.
Me too? No, not you.
Well, we want to thank you for bringing him and Oscar to us. I mean, you know, it's funny. Some people have their inner child, and Big Bird and Oscar have their inner adult.
Yeah, I guess they do.
That's you. Thank you.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Bye.
Bye. Have a rotten day.
Carol Spinney in 2003. He died Sunday at the age of 85. You know, I've spoken to presidents, but speaking to Oscar, highlight of my life. I'm not crying. You're crying.
When it's too cold to go out or too icy to make it out of the driveway, where do you go to find just the right movie, just the right book, just the right show to binge? Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR can help you keep warm and keep up at the same time. Join us twice a week on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Adulting has become a popular term used by young people still figuring out what it means to be an adult. Now colleges are embracing the word and offering adulting workshops. As Stephen Bisaha of the Kansas News Service reports, Kansas State University hopes students don't just learn how to change a tire, but also how to bounce back from tough times.
First, a definition of adulting from Kansas State University senior Frankie Skinner.
Things that are not taught in school that make us feel stressed when we don't know how to do them.
And used in a sentence?
When I have to go grocery shopping by myself, I'm adulting.
Okay, it's easy to mock college students for not knowing how to order a quarter pound of cheese in the deli section. But well-meaning helicopter parenting hasn't fostered self-sufficient kids. And educators say schools have focused so much on testing and drilling book smarts, there's been little room for teaching students how to manage life without their parents. K-State student Anna Trainum felt the weight of that college and test prep obsession.
In high school, I felt really pressured to take a lot of college classes to succeed because there was a huge race for like valedictorian and like being top of the class. And no matter how high your GPA was, everybody was still stressed. Like, you had to take college classes. You had to do perfect all the time.
That's why K-State started offering Adulting 101 classes this year. The non-credit workshops include car maintenance, building good credit, and food safety. That one is taught by student dietitians like Anna Biggins.
How many of you guys have asked yourself this question when you're maybe getting ready to eat something or opening up the fridge, being like, what is that? Or can I still eat that?
Wichita State University, the University of Nebraska, and other schools have also been offering adulting workshops. The stress of not feeling prepared for adult life is part of the reason psychologists say there's a college mental health crisis. The National Healthy Mind Study found the rate of college students getting mental health treatment went from 19% to 34% from 2007 to 2017. And that leads us to another buzzword on campus, resilience. This time defined by K-State health educator Megan Catt.
The ability to overcome and move forward toward some goal.
Catt says the adulting workshops help build that resilience by preparing students to better handle their own problems, like having a car breakdown. Northeastern University professor Kristen Lee says the approach has merit for another reason. Students might end up less stressed when they see other students needing an adulting class too, and that the school is willing to help. Lee defines that as supervised skill practice.
Which is just really a fancy way of saying community, accountability, support, knowing you're not the only one to grapple with a particular issue.
Laura Horn is the chief program officer with Active Minds, a mental health advocacy organization. She says building resilient students is important, but dealing with a campus mental health crisis requires a culture shift where all students and staff feel comfortable talking about these issues.
It's a long game. This is really difficult work to do, but it is the work worth doing.
And balancing those long and short-term solutions will require colleges doing some top-level adulting. For Here and Now, I'm Stephen Bisaha.
Today, the House Judiciary Committee is hearing evidence from Democratic and Republican lawyers on President Trump's dealings with Ukraine, making the case for and against impeachment. Testimony today may influence the articles of impeachment being drafted by House Democrats and whether they'll broaden their scope beyond Ukraine to include obstruction of justice charges tied to the president's attempts to interfere with the Mueller investigation. The beginning of the hearing was interrupted by a protester yelling that the Democrats were committing treason. Then in his opening statement, Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler said President Trump put his own interests before the country's.
As we proceed today, we will hear a great deal about the speed with which the House is addressing the president's actions. To the members of the committee, to the members of the House, and to my fellow citizens, I want to be absolutely clear. The integrity of our next election is at stake. Nothing could be more urgent. The president welcomed foreign interference in our elections in 2016. He demanded it for 2020. Then he got caught. If you do not believe that he will do it again, let me remind you that the president's personal lawyer spent last week back in Ukraine meeting with government officials in an apparent attempt to gin up the same so-called favors that brought us here today and forced Congress to consider the impeachment of a sitting president. This pattern of conduct represents a continuing risk to the country. The evidence shows that Donald J. Trump, the president of the United States, has put himself before his country. He has violated his most basic responsibilities to the people. He has broken his oath. I will honor mine. If you would honor yours, then I would urge you to do your duty. Let us review the record here in full view of the American people, and then let us move swiftly to defend our country.
The Republican case today is focused on the way the Democrats have been handling the impeachment process, as Nadler said. They say it's an excuse to get rid of a Republican president they don't like. In his opening statement, the ranking Republican, Doug Collins, referred to this as the Democrats' focus group impeachment.
There have been famous moments in impeachment as we've gone forward. There are famous lines from Nixon, like, what did the president know and when did he know it? From the Clinton impeachment, there was, I did not have sex with that woman. What would be known about this one is probably, where's the impeachable offense? Why are we here? I tell you, this may be, though, become known as the focus group impeachment. Because we don't have a crime, we don't have anything we can actually pin, and nobody understands really what the majority is trying to do, except that interfere and basically make sure that they believe the president can't win next year if he's impeached. The focus group impeachment takes words and then takes them to people and say, how can we explain this better? Because we don't have the facts to match it. A focus group impeachment says, you know, we really aren't working with good facts, but we need a good PR move. That's why we're here today. This is all about, as I said last week, a clock and a calendar. And it really became evident to me that this was true because last Wednesday, after we had a long day of hearing here, the next morning, before anything else could get started, the Speaker of the House walked up to the podium and said, go write articles of impeachment. She just quit. She just stopped. Go write articles of impeachment. I appreciate that the majority practiced for 2 days this weekend on this hearing. I appreciate that the fact that you got to try and get it right to try and convince the American people of your problem, but your speaker's already undercut you. She took the thrill out of the room. You're writing articles of impeachment. Why couldn't we just save that time today, and if you're going to write the articles of impeachment, go ahead and write them? Well, there's probably a reason for that, because the chairman laid out some amazing claims, none of which I think after this hearing today, the American people can honestly look at and see that there is overwhelming evidence, there is a proper reason he abused this power, because as the speaker, another statement she said, that to do impeachment you have to be so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, all of which we are not.
By the way, with that speech, Collins launched a Twitter storm of suggestions for memorable impeachment lines, including, yes, there was obstruction of justice, and do me a favor, though. Also today, Republicans delayed proceedings with points of order several times throughout the hearing.
Show me, please, in the rule. Have your parliamentarian show me in the rules where you come to a time of actually being able to deny this up at a certain point.
Further reserving the right to object.
As I have said, the point of order would be an order at the meeting where we are considering articles.
Further reserving the right to object.
We will now hear presentations.
Mr. Chairman, I appeal the decision of the chair.
There's no decision to appeal. There was not a ruling and a motion. We will now hear presentations.
There's a ruling on the point of order.
You made a ruling on the point of order.
You made a ruling on the point of order, Mr. Chairman. You can't then not allow us to appeal the ruling of the chair.
The gentleman will suspend. It was not a cognizable point of order. It was not a cognizable point of order. It was not in order at this time to make that point of order. There is no ruling to appeal.
But Mr. Chairman, the rule was for the obligation, not consideration. You are obligated to schedule, not to consider, made a ruling. It is in order to appeal.
The gentleman will suspend. We are doing what we have to do under the rules. We will now hear presentations of evidence.
Mr. Chairman,
the gentleman is not recognized. We will now hear presentations of evidence.
I have a parliamentary inquiry.
I haven't removed my objection yet.
I will not recognize a parliamentary inquiry at this time. We will now hear presentations of evidence from counsels to the judiciary.
Is this when we just hear staff ask questions of other staff and the members get dealt out of this whole hearing? And for the next 4 hours, you're going to try to overturn the result of an election with unelected people giving testimony?
Gentlemen will suspend.
That last voice, the Republican Matt Gaetz, objecting to Chairman Nadler's refusal so far to grant Republicans' request for a minority hearing day. The Republican Stephen Castor, Republican lawyer for the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees, made the case today that there's not enough evidence that the president committed any impeachable offense. Here he is referring to Trump's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian President Zelensky, which alarmed the whistleblower and set off this impeachment inquiry.
The purpose of this hearing, as we understand it, is to discuss whether President Donald J. Trump's conduct fits the definition of a high crime and misdemeanor. It does not. Such that the committee should consider articles of impeachment to remove the president from office, and it should not. This case, in many respects, comes down to 8 lines in a call transcript. Let me say clearly and unequivocally that the answer to that question is no. The record in the Democrats' impeachment inquiry does not show that President Trump abused the power of his office or obstructed Congress. To impeach a president who 63 million people voted for over 8 lines in a call transcript is baloney.
But here is Daniel Goldman, chief House Intelligence Committee investigator, laying out evidence that President Trump did abuse his power.
The extensive evidence that the committees uncovered during this investigation led to the following critical findings. First, President Trump used the power of his office to pressure and induce the newly elected president of Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 presidential election for President Trump's personal and political benefit. Second, in order to increase the pressure on Ukraine to announce the politically motivated investigations that President Trump wanted, President Trump withheld a coveted Oval Office meeting and $391 of essential military assistance from Ukraine. Third, President Trump's conduct sought to undermine our free and fair elections and poses an imminent threat to our national security. And fourth, faced with the revelation of his pressure campaign against Ukraine, President Trump directed an unprecedented effort to obstruct Congress's impeachment inquiry into his conduct. And with that context in mind, I would like to turn to the evidence of President Trump's conduct concerning Ukraine. My colleague, Mr. Castor, just said that it revolves around 8 lines in one call record. But that sorely ignores the vast amount of evidence that we collected of a months-long scheme directed by the president.
Just some highlights from today's House Judiciary Committee hearing on impeachment. We'll, of course, continue to cover this for you here and now.
Former Fed Chair Paul Volcker has died at age 92. He had a hand in U.S. economic policy for more than 3 decades, serving both Democratic and Republican administrations. Volcker famously brought high inflation down when he was Fed Chair in the 1980s, and more recently he became known for what we call the Volcker Rule, passed after the 2008 financial crisis and weakened recently by the Trump administration. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington as he does each Monday. And Derek, Paul Volcker, as I mentioned, is someone who has worked in a range of capacities, and he also worked with a lot of people. What's been the reaction to his death?
I don't think there's any doubt that he was one of the most important economic figures of the last 50 years. People are calling him a giant of the field, and it's not just because he happened to stand a full 6'7" tall. Conservatives credit him with rescuing the economy from crippling inflation, as you said, the 1970s and early 1980s. But it's also the case that a lot of liberal economists consider him a brilliant economic thinker and one of the most important Fed chairs in recent memory, in large part the Fed chair who sort of created this modern expectation that the chair of the Federal Reserve should be a kind of Wizard of Oz figure with extraordinary power over the economy that both parties defer to.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Volcker's defining achievement was his success in ending that extended period of high inflation after President Jimmy Carter chose him to be the Fed chair back in 1979. And back then, inflation was around 14%. But he wasn't really popular during that time. What exactly did he do, and why was it so controversial during that time?
Yeah, so let's go back to the 1970s. Inflation is skyrocketing. Prices are rising, or were rising then in the 1970s, about 10 times faster than they are in 2019. And policymakers at the time had no idea what to do about it. They didn't even really know what was causing this hyperinflation, or at least rampant inflation. And Volcker becomes chairman of the Federal Reserve in the late 1970s, and he says, "This is on us." Us meaning the Federal Reserve. This is not the job of the president to solve. It's not the job of fiscal policy. This is on us. We're going back to Econ 101. Inflation is caused by excessive growth in money and credit. And if you want to fight inflation, you have to shut off the spigot of money and credit. So he comes up with this policy of shock therapy, which drives up interest rates. It drives the economy into a deep recession. Unemployment, as you said, skyrockets. But inflation does come down, and it has stayed down really for the last 4 decades.
Let's fast forward to President Obama, who chose Volcker to chair the President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board. That was after that 2008 financial crisis, and that led to the creation of what I mentioned as the Volcker Rule. Can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, so the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009 was clearly exacerbated by the activities of investment banks and by the bad bets of investment banks. And a lot of people lost money during the Great Recession. And so Volcker comes along and he has a testimony in front of Congress where he essentially says, look, we need to pass something into law that splits up the kind of banks that can do this activity. We can't have federally insured banks engaging in this kind of risky trading, especially if it's with their own money. So effectively, mm-hmm. what he did is he forced a lot of traders to leave investment banks and start their own hedge funds with, you know, principal funding from outside, you know, typical mom and pop commercial checking accounts. So essentially what the Volcker rule has done in effect is it has split commercial banks, or, you know, federally insured banks that you and I might have our money in, and hedge funds that might engage in riskier trading. And the hope going forward, even though this rule has been weakened by some Trump-era regulation policy. Yes, exactly. Yeah. The hope is that by keeping commercial banks a little more plain vanilla, we won't have another economic crisis that's as deep.
As you mentioned, people hold his name in high esteem. But what do you think will be Paul Volcker's legacy, and what lessons do you think current Fed chairs will take from his life?
I think there are three main parts to his legacy. The first part is that, as I said, today we treat the Fed chair as a kind of supra-political, above-politics Wizard of Oz figure who we look to save mm-hmm. the economy. And leaders from both parties do this. Leaders from both parties often defer to the central bank to make really important decisions about the future of the economy. This, in many ways, is an outcome of Volcker being seen as successful in breaking the back of inflation in the early 1980s. That leads to number two. He did break the back of inflation. And if you look at inflation over the last four decades, it's been really low. This is a part of the world that we deal with, which is relatively and sometimes surprisingly low inflation. But there's also a dark side to Volcker's legacy that's important to point out. You know, here you have an unelected elite who in the early 1980s, many people saw as purposely crashing the economy. And millions of people lost their jobs. Unemployment soared to 10%. Farmers protested. Construction workers sent 2x4s to the Fed's headquarters to urge them to stop this policy of shock therapy. And so in many ways, I think a lot of people look back to this era of the early 1980s as the beginning of a neoliberal technocratic era that we're just now potentially emerging from. So it's a complex legacy, but in many ways we're still living
legacy.
With it.
Yes, Derek Thompson, senior editor of The Atlantic, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.